Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program, is South Africa ready for another July 2021, or are the warning lights already flashing ahead of the June 30 immigration deadline? Tongaat Hulett's rescue raises a bigger question: are businesses acting before it's too late? Young South Africans are buying more new cars despite tighter budgets. What is driving the shift? And after years of leaving, some South Africans are coming back and they are buying property again. It's Monday, the 22nd of June. Now, President Ramaphosa may have rejected the June 30 anti-immigration deadline, but concerns are growing that the issue has taken on a real momentum of its own, with fears of social unrest, tensions around migration, questions over police readiness, and the specter of the July 2021 riots still hanging over the country. I think it's fair to say that many people are asking whether South Africa's institutions are prepared for what comes next. I'm going to talk now to Natasha Marion, senior researcher at the Bureau for Economic Research. Natasha, June 30, and welcome to you. Do you think it's become more than simply an anti-immigration campaign, but maybe evolving into a broader test of the state's authority?
Absolutely, Jeremy. You know, the difficulty that the government faces is that the various anti-immigrant groupings have sort of aligned themselves politically by appearing at rallies, for instance, of political parties. And political parties have tried to join those protests. We've seen Action SA on the ground with March in March to take advantage of the groundswell of support these movements are actually garnering before the local government election. And KZN is a particular hotspot for this movement. And we know the proximity between the leader of the March in March movement, Ms. Jacinta Ngubesi Zuma, and the MK party. She appeared at their rally 2 weeks ago. So it is causing deep concern over a spillover into the political realm across the country, but in KZN more particularly.
Government, of course, insisting there is no crisis at all. But do you think political insiders and maybe the security establishment privately is a little bit more concerned?
Absolutely. That is the sense we're getting, Jeremy, that there is really deep concern about it, given, you know, the revelations at the Madlanga Commission has shocked the country since the beginning of the commission last year. But the impact of that commission is, you know, we have very many police officers, senior police officers on suspension. The National Police Commissioner is suspended voluntarily. He's facing charges. His replacement, General Dimpane, is highly competent, but what's interesting about her is that she has a finance and accounting background as opposed to one on the ground and an operational background. And then we saw what happened on Friday, where IDAC sought to arrest the crime intelligence head, Mr. Dumisani Khumalo. And that put a spanner in the works. The justice minister had to intervene in that because he is part of the ground operations ahead of the June 30 deadline. So there is heightened concern about the SAP's capacity to handle a repeat of July 21.
And that's the real issue, that if there is unrest, there are question marks about whether the state would be able to contain it effectively and quickly, or possibly looking at vulnerabilities that haven't been fixed since 2021.
No, absolutely. Now, this is the problem. You know, the Madlanga Commission is probing corruption effectively. It's probing corruption. It's probing capture. But there has been no real reform of the SAPs between the period 2021 and now. And we know that investigations by a high-level panel, as well as the Human Rights Commission in 2021, found that the SAPs were just, you know, completely overwhelmed. They lacked resources. In some cases, SAPs members even joined the looting by community members. So very little has changed, but there is this weakness at the top levels of the SAPs. However, I must say, Jeremy, that the police minister did come out this morning and say very clearly that police will have everything under control. It's just a matter of believability right now.
The SAPS is one thing, of course, but also questions around the SANDF. How worrying are concerns about discipline and command structures there, and what role might that entity play in all of this?
You know, the president has already called out the SANDF. They are helping until March 2027 in areas where illicit mining is on the go. They have been called in to assist the SAPS already. It is likely that they could be called in if things go out of control. But, you know, we have a situation where our defense force defied the president in January this year with regard to Iran's participation in the naval exercises off the Cape Coast. Now, a panel was convened to investigate that. The report has been given to the president, but we've heard nothing about that since because that report has been kept under the wraps. So we do have a very tense situation between the SANDF and the president. We don't know what that report says, but we also have the ongoing fight between the executive and the SANDF over their budget. So you know, it's there's all these elements around the SANDF that do render it concerning for them to participate in this current impasse with anti-immigration groups.
Natasha, from a risk planning perspective, how worried do you think business should be?
This is the difficulty. I think past experience shows us that business should be worried about, especially the day, June 30. You know, we've seen in Pietermaritzburg last week, a mob attacked some people in Johannesburg. You know, shops are being approached by these anti-immigrant movements. And the, you know, mass protests could very easily get out of control. So I think definitely the day, June 30, should be flagged as a risk for business.
And inevitably, immigration is likely to become a proxy battle in the run-up to the local government elections in November, surely.
Absolutely. It already is, which is why we're seeing political parties rallying around this movement, and which is why we're seeing such a big shift in the ANC's stance over immigration. I mean, just as recent as 2019, the ANC's approach was the direct opposite of what it is now. You know, we had President Ramaphosa come out in his address to the nation and admit that this is a problem in South Africa, whereas the ANC has historically been in denial about how much of a problem it was and how much of a problem the porous borders and the really corrupt Home Affairs Department has been in the South African political landscape. So we have seen quite a shift, and very much so because it's drawn the imagination of voters in the country. And we have an election in less than 4 months.
Natasha Marion, Senior Researcher at the Bureau for Economic Research, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Tongaat-Hulett rescue may have dominated headlines, but perhaps the more important question is what it says about the health of South African business. Too often, companies wait until options have completely disappeared before confronting distress. Hennick O'Shalakamp is the Chief Executive Officer of Accounting and Advisory Group HLBCBS, and he joins us now to discuss why successful business rescue is about preserving value, about protecting ecosystems and creating sustainable businesses rather than simply delaying failure. Hennick, a very warm welcome to you. Why do you think then so many executives refuse to acknowledge distress until it's almost too late?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity and welcome to the listeners. I think sometimes there could be some hope that things will maybe get better in the future. But what's very important is to act quickly. Normally, in the beginning, it's much easier to restructure because you will have still options available, especially if the business is in a loss-making position. But most of the time, it can still be good businesses like Tongaat Hulett is a good business. And my view is they can definitely get it back on the right track.
You talk about acting quickly. Do you think, though, denial among boards and management or exco teams is one of the biggest destroyers of value?
Yes. Sometimes these individuals, they can also be in a position where they stress a bit, and maybe they hope things will change. We must also take into account that the last couple of years was a very tough economy globally. So sometimes they don't take immediate action, but what would be a good thing to do is to then go and discuss these type of issues with corporate financiers, because they obviously have access to private equity funds and institutions. In Tongaat case, they were a listed company, so they had other options. Like, they could have used right issues, they could have put a formal plan together, but yeah, they did wait for too long, in my view.
At some point, though, a company does move from being temporarily stressed to being fundamentally broken. Is there a specific red flag in that case?
Yes, you must look at the financial ratios on the balance sheet. So it is possible that the company is making profits, but it's got no cash flow because there's delay in debtor payments, or it's like maybe shipments in the sea and they're struggling to get the product to their offices. So what has also happened in the past, companies with strong balance sheets couldn't trade because of cash flow issues. And that's where it's important to take decisions quickly and raise additional capital for these timing differences.
Do you think, Henico, there's still stigma attached to restructuring in South Africa and going into business rescue?
I think there's very few examples where business rescue has worked. So I think the boards are often scared to go into business rescue. And then if you go into business rescue, you do hand over the business in a way to business rescue practitioners, so they might feel they won't have much input into the business. So I think that's why it's not used often. But in the case of Tongaat, it really can destroy a lot of things. It's been noted that they've saved approximately 250,000 jobs, and it's pretty much the whole KwaZulu-Natal economy. If that company fell, it would have had a huge impact on cane growers in certain areas like Mpumalanga and KwaZulu-Natal. There's not necessarily other options available for these farmers and their workers.
And any business that is going to think about business rescue has got to look at the wider impact. And you rightly referenced the Tongaat case, a lot of headlines about the company, but there wasn't that much conversation about growers, suppliers, and even the communities that depend on that. And that's the point that you're making.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's far more than just the shareholders that lost money. It's like, how many families does 250,000 employees support? Yes, it's all those farmers that work closely with Tongaat. And if they didn't manage to conclude this deal, I think it would have had devastating impact for all those businesses. Yeah.
But sometimes there's a lot of short-sightedness. Lenders and shareholders, I imagine, are sometimes guilty of prioritizing their own narrow interests at the expense of longer-term value.
Yes, unfortunately that would happen. I'm sure the bankers would have been quite scared to put extra capital in. The same with shareholders, especially all the negative headlines that was also in the media. On all the irregularities. So I think that just made it much, much worse.
And Henico, in your experience, what then distinguishes a business that emerges stronger from one that simply survives?
I think you must go and look at the overall health of the business. You mustn't only look at what's on the balance sheet, but also what is the opportunities of a business. So if you can see there's good long-term opportunities, there's an opportunity to grow or maybe scale the business a bit, but only needs capital, then those are the businesses that you want to back and put additional money in. And I think that was the view that was taken by Vision and the IDC to take on this initiative to effectively save Tongaat Ulet. Because if it went into liquidation, then they would have broken it up in parts. I think there could have been a lot of retrenchments. It would have been a really ugly situation.
There are a lot of lessons from that particular business case. I'm going to leave it there. Henico Schalekamp, thank you very much indeed. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Accounting and Advisory Group, HLBCBS. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, young South Africans, I don't need to tell you, are under enormous and growing financial pressure. Yet new data from Absa Vehicle Finance is suggesting that millennials and Gen Zers are increasingly buying new vehicles rather than used ones. And the trend points, I think, to changing attitudes around affordability, around financing, and consumer confidence. So let's try and make some sense of this. Henry Boerte is with me now, Head of Strategy and Business Analytics at Absa Vehicle Finance. Henry, on the face of it, and welcome to you, this sounds positive, but I've got to ask myself this question. Are young South Africans becoming wealthier or simply taking on more debt?
I don't think it's a case of either two. I think taking on debt is pretty much limited to what the National Credit Act allows. And that it's a very good act that caps if your expenses are higher than a certain percentage, you won't be able to get the loan and banks won't be allowed to give you that loan. So I think it's more a case of what we've seen in the market and the type of vehicles that's been introduced over the past 2 years that gives a young first-time car buyer, or even a second and third, if you look to the ages up to 35, there's so much more that you can choose from now. And it's in a good price bracket, especially with this segment hunting for vehicles between 200,000 and 300,000 rand. So what has happened is you now have so much more option in that price range for a new vehicle. And most probably you're going to look for an SUV, which is the trend, rather than buying a used vehicle that might have been a hatchback or a sedan or something that's, let me say, out of date of what consumers are preferring today.
Which tells us just how significantly Chinese brands are disrupting the traditional market.
I think it's Chinese brands, yes, and also vehicles that are built in India at a lower price point that we get in South Africa. And in most developing countries are benefiting from that lower cost base for manufacturing vehicles. We've had the introduction of Tata recently, and it seems like they're selling a lot of cars. And it was a manufacturer that didn't exist in our country since, I think, for the past 5 years. So a consumer now can go and rather buy a new vehicle, newly introduced, with a warranty, all the benefits of that, and the used cars are being traded in for them.
There is risk, though, attached to this equation. I read that more than 90% are financing over periods longer than 6 years. Is that sustainable?
I think what consumers do is they take the maximum period for the lowest installment, with the option for those that have the means to pay in an additional amount, which you can do on your vehicle finance. You can pay off your car quicker if you choose to, the same way that you can do on your home loan. And that way, if you keep that discipline, like you get your bonus next year, you pay in the additional amount, you can pay off the car quicker than what you originally agreed over the term of the loan. And I really encourage that, because you want to be in a position, if this is your first car, that it can serve as a deposit for the next car. Yes, cars are depreciating assets, but if it can just pay it off quicker than it depreciates, then you've got a deposit for the next one, and you can get in a better car at the same installment as what you're currently paying.
Do you think buyers could find themselves underwater, though, either if used car values weaken or if interest rates remain elevated?
Yes, we've seen it. I think it was prior to the subprime crisis. I'm going back more than 20 years now, where South Africa were at record low interest rates for the first time, I think, in 30 years. We had house prices that kept on increasing. They were good investments. We had a very stable rand. I think we strengthened against the dollar for like 3 years in a row, and it caused all new vehicle prices to deflate. But the vehicle manufacturers didn't decrease the prices. They just increased the extras that you get. The motor plans were introduced back then. So all of those did put pressure on the used market. But this is the same as any economic cycle. It goes up and down. So when you sell good value new vehicles, those become good value used vehicles 1, 2, 3 years from now. So I do expect maybe there's a little bit of more stock available in used vehicles now. I don't think it's like a bubble that's going to burst or anything like that. I think our car buying public is able to absorb it and buy it and our dealerships as well. But I do look forward to all the new vehicles being sold now being available at good value in a few years' time.
Henry, you talk about this cohort being better at spotting value. Are you also suggesting that technology that exists in all of these vehicles now and the warranty protection that you also alluded to becomes more important than the outright price?
I do think those play a very big role. We're all connected with our devices, so you want a car that's connected. Not all used cars have that technology. You can find value in how vehicles are manufactured these days at a lower... We didn't experience that. All we experienced post-COVID was that vehicles became extraordinarily expensive. And now we're in a phase where you've got low new vehicle price inflation and you can get better value from that new vehicle. So I do think this younger generation also does their research very much so digitally before they even walk into a dealership floor. So as in many cases, they might know more than a person that's trying to sell them the car what they are trying to buy. And that can benefit you if you've done your research, you walk in, you know what you want, and you know at what price point you should be able to get it.
And just a final question then, extrapolate this if you can. If you look beyond vehicles, does it tell us anything about the broader financial health and priorities of younger South Africans?
There is some data available just to see what the indebtedness is of younger South Africans. You know, we haven't had, let's say, occupation growth or salary growth for quite a while. But there is always a cycle of younger buyers coming in. And I think we also sit in a society where young buyers aren't single income earners anymore. They've got side hustles. They've got plan Bs. They are making money in more ways than one. And they could even depend on family to go and buy, let's say, the first vehicle within that family with some support of family members. So I do think as a South African youth that there's ways that they are able to solve for that us as older gents and ladies didn't solve for in the past. And you can see that coming up more and more where consumers are claiming they have a second income that they want to use as part of their finance application. So that is something of a trend that's coming through, but not yet like fully analyzed.
Henry, you've made me very nostalgic for my secondhand Toyota Taz that was my very first car, but that was a long time ago. I'm going to leave it there. Henry Boita, Head of Strategy and Business Analytics at Absa Vehicle Finance. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
For years, I think the story has been one-way traffic with South Africans leaving for opportunities abroad. But now estate agents and wealth managers are reporting growing interest from South Africans overseas looking to buy property back home. So I've got to ask, is this nostalgia? Is it a seek for better lifestyle or maybe just hard-nosed and hard-headed economics? Someone who has a view on this and a regular guest on the program is Grant Smee, Chief Executive Officer of Only Realty Property Group. Grant, welcome back. Are people really coming home or are they simply parking money in South African property?
So I think it's actually a combination of both. I think there's a large number of people that are returning home from Europe, Australia and the US, but there's also people that are parking money here for future investments, seeing the value of property in South Africa.
Where are they seeing value in property specifically, and what type of property are we talking about?
So I think there's a combination. If they're coming back to live, they're looking at lifestyle properties, and we've seen a big boom in estates. And obviously, again, people returning from overseas are predominantly looking at coastal regions. So we've seen massive increase in values in the North Coast and the well-known Western Cape areas. And then from an investment point of view, actually, they seem to be following the trends of local investors investing in sectional title complexes and opportunities in both the economic hubs of Pretoria and Joburg, as well as, again, the coastal regions.
And the reality of the situation is the world has just got a whole lot smaller, and there is an ability now to earn foreign currency while living locally. That must change the emigration equation, because you did reference the desire for lifestyle, and make no mistake, it does exist in abundance here.
Yeah, I think the big story over the last 2 years has been this nomad visa story, and nomads living in South Africa working remotely. And I think that the opportunity has really now presented itself to South Africans who left the country for economic reasons and are seeing the ability to return but continue earning foreign currency.
You talk about the Western Cape dominating this conversation, and that's well documented and well understood. But Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, is there also renewed interest there?
Absolutely. So the KwaZulu-Natal in particular is a very interesting one. Again, it's a significant amount of development in there, a significant amount of value, and then very commutable into the economic hub of Joburg, but also a beautiful space from a lifestyle perspective. And then Gauteng, again, you know, it does attract people who like the hustle and bustle of the city, of the environment, and it is a good place to live. And there's significantly good value in properties in Gauteng and Joburg at the moment.
Security, of course, Grant, always remains a concern. Has that become any factor at all in attracting returning buyers?
Definitely. I think, security is obviously one of the main drivers behind decision-making of any South African buying a property in South Africa. And I think that remains the same for buyers from abroad. They do come in with a high level of skepticism and fear of crime in South Africa, and therefore add a massive premium onto security. So the attraction for them is spaces that are much more, or seem much more secure than other units.
Do you think I'm over-amplifying it if I say quality of life has now become more important than politics?
I think definitely that is the case, you know, and I think we're seeing the issues in Europe and the UK in particular are really speaking loudly to that political issues are global at the moment, and I think people are now prioritizing lifestyle over politics.
And it's not just the property itself, but it's also the wider community and the network, I would imagine. In that respect, schools and maybe even family support networks are also influential, perhaps even more influential than the property price itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when people move abroad, they do lose their support networks, and they gain that when they come back to South Africa. And then from an education point of view, we can't discount the education system in South Africa, in particular the private education system and private schools, where they have now access to, which is significantly cheaper in South Africa than to overseas, particularly UK and Europe. So I think, again, a massive amount of value is added to the ability for them for people returning to send their kids to private schools in South Africa.
And that's absolutely critical. Are you able to quantify to what extent South Africa offers exceptional or better value, Grant, say, compared with London, Sydney or New York?
So very difficult for me to do that. But I think, again, you're probably paying a third of the price of local South African private schools to which you are internationally. And that speaks both to international private schools as well as private schools available in the UK and Europe and the US. So it's... you know, there's particularly huge amounts of discounted value sending kids to South African private schools.
But make no mistake, there's always risk attached to this. And I'm just wondering whether the trend could be reversed by political instability or deteriorating infrastructure. And of that, in particularly in Gauteng, that is evident.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, Gauteng obviously is going through a transition at the moment, and I think everybody's watching quite closely what's going to happen over the next sort of year, particularly with the local government elections in Gauteng. I do think that although Gauteng might struggle with people coming back because of infrastructure issues and political issues, we can look at the north coast of KZN and the Western Cape as places that people will continue to return to, because they have over the last sort of 10, 15, 20 years proven themselves to be good places to invest and live.
So just a final question then, looking at your data, do you think that returning expats are voting with their hearts, in other words, nostalgia, just wanting to come back, or do you think there is a rational investment decision which is based purely on value?
So again, I think it's both. You know, nostalgia and warmth towards South Africa is a very difficult one to drop, particularly if you've spent most of your life and grown up in South Africa. You know, it's an easy place to leave your heart when you leave. The rationale behind the investment is actually a really good one, both from a lifestyle perspective in terms of the experience that they're having overseas, as well as the investment opportunity. Even though, for example, Cape Town and the Western Cape is priced high for South Africans, it's actually really good value for people that have earned foreign currency. If they compare property pricing to where they are in Europe or the US to South Africa, and then there's great opportunities and like I said earlier, discounted opportunities in Gauteng at the moment. Gauteng is definitely in a place where there's real value in purchasing property at the moment.
Grant Smee, as always, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of Only Realty Property Group. And on that note, we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.